This is a podcast from Deutsche Welle. For more information and a selection of other programs, click on to dwworld.de.
Deutsche Welle. Inside Europe.
Hello and welcome to Inside Europe. I'm Chuck Penfold in Bonn. On today's program, an 11th-hour deal to contain the Eurozone's sovereign debt crisis.
We are not going to solve the euro crisis today. We are not even going to solve it tomorrow. But we are headed roughly in the right direction, with many possible landmines still in the way. So watch out.
Also on Inside Europe, a devastating earthquake highlights Turkey's ethnic divide. Chinese investors snap up property in London, and the last word in luxury takes shape in Switzerland. Those stories and more coming up on the program. European Union politicians put in a lot of overtime this past week. EU leaders held not one but two summits to try to agree on a plan to contain the Eurozone's sovereign debt crisis, and in particular to reduce Greece's debt burden. A three-part plan was reached after the second summit, a marathon meeting in Brussels, during which talks often verged on collapse. Banks accepted to take on huge losses on Greek debt, and the EU's bailout fund was boosted to around 1 trillion euros. However, much of the detail has yet to be hammered out. Vanessa Mock reports from Brussels.
Prime Minister, is this the moment now? It's been called the 100-hour marathon to save the Eurozone. Two summits in 4 days, crisis talks across European capitals, from Athens to Rome, Berlin to Brussels. And as she arrived to Brussels on Wednesday night for part two of this EU summit, German Chancellor Angela Merkel promised that this time EU leaders would deliver.
We still have to solve a lot of problems and hold a lot of negotiations, so the work is not yet done. But I think we are on the right track, and we will achieve a good part of the work today.
The idea was to have a deal in place by the time the first markets in Asia opened at around midnight. It's just turned 2 a.m. here in the vast atrium of the EU Council building. Diplomats have just said that talks have broken down and there are hundreds of tired journalists desperate to go home. One of them is Marco Zatterin. Marco, you're from La Stampa, an Italian newspaper. Is this cause for despair, do you think?
I'm not panicking. I mean, we can sing the famous summit song, which is "Let's tweet again like we did last summit," which could be fun. But if you want to be serious, you got to understand that this is a serious project, a difficult project. It will take a lot of time. This is not a Windows application. You just click and move your hand and the problem is solved.
Jeff Mead from the Press Association. We've been here quite a lot, haven't we, in the past 18 months?
And we have been. How many summits this year alone? Five or six or something?
A spokesperson who's not allowed to speak to us, but she can perhaps give us a number.
Nine? Five?
95?
95.
This might be the sixth, I think. And yeah, we see the same old face. It's like some big, mad social club, isn't it? But I'll tell you what, seriously, what is really interesting is that we've had this series of summits about this one issue, and every summit, I think I could have written exactly the same story. EU leaders have made progress towards solving one of the biggest crises since the Second World War, etc., etc., etc. But I don't see any real difference.
At 5 a.m., the suspense finally ended. Well, we just heard that there is now a deal at the 11th hour. What's been holding us up all this time is how to reduce Greece's debt burden. EU leaders have been pushing the banks to write off billions of the debt that they hold, 50%. And we're just about to hear an announcement by the EU President, Herman Van Rompuy.
It also includes a voluntary contribution by private creditors who had lent to Greece. It was agreed by them tonight and amounts to a nominal discount of 50% of Greek debt.
There's also been a deal to boost the firepower of the EU's bailout fund. Now a complex mechanism is in place to leverage the fund, or the EFSF, so that it can raise 1 trillion euros. It's a piece of financial engineering that very few people here at the summit seem to understand, but European Commission President José Manuel Barroso called it a triumph.
We have agreed to endorse 2 options for leveraging the EFSF. Together, this will allow us to more effectively prevent contagion. I have long insisted on the necessity to equip the EFSF with adequate flexibility and resources, so I'm particularly pleased with this decision.
But there is considerable doubt as to whether the deal really stands up.
Well, it's a deal certainly the leaders were holding out for. Any deal would have been good. They got to a magic trillion for the EU's bailout fund.
Anton LaGuardia is from The Economist magazine.
Is that the big bazooka? It's got lots of zeros. Does it also have lots of holes in it? This is yet to be seen. There's lots of caveats. We'll have to see how the markets react to it.
Sonny Kapoor from the financial think tank Redefine is even more doubtful.
Neither of these options is going to sort out the crisis. In the end, this is only going to be temporary, and the European Central Bank will have to step in a much bigger way than it is.
The first big test for this comprehensive package on the Eurozone is how the markets have reacted. And so far, that's been positive. But it will take many more weeks for the details of this agreement to be fully hammered out.
We are not going to solve the euro crisis today. We are not even going to solve it tomorrow. But we are headed roughly in the right direction, with many possible landmines still in the way. So watch out.
And so until another Eurozone summit, this is Vanessa Mock for Deutsche Welle in Brussels.
Last Sunday's earthquake in eastern Turkey left hundreds of people dead and made tens of thousands homeless. It also highlighted the troubled relations between Turks and Kurds. The quake happened in a predominantly Kurdish part of the country and occurred just days after the Kurdish separatist group, the PKK, killed 24 Turkish soldiers. Turkey's armed forces responded with air and land operations in which dozens of PKK fighters were killed. The response to the earthquake has seen both a humanitarian show of support, but also ugly expressions of nationalism by some Turks towards the survivors. As Dorian Jones reports, the disaster is being seen as a crucial test for the country.
At the same time, the predominantly Kurdish region of Van was being devastated by an earthquake. Turks were demonstrating across the country against the killing of 24 Turkish soldiers by the Kurdish rebel group, the PKK. It was an outpouring of grief and fury. But even as the magnitude of the disaster became clear, with rescue workers battling to save those trapped, well-known TV presenter Mugay Unla provoked a storm of controversy, questioning why Turks should help those in such desperate need.
First, they throw stones at the police and kill our soldiers in the mountains. But when they're in trouble, they want the army and the police to come to their aid.
After a storm of protests, Anla was forced to apologize. But political columnist Asla Aydıntaşbaş of the Turkish newspaper Milliyet says Anla's mistake was to say on TV what many other Turks feel.
Coming right after PKK attack here, where 24 people died, there is a certain amount of racism in some quarters. We see this in social media. People are saying that they're not going to grieve for the earthquake precisely because people that have died have not grieved for the loss of lives of Turkish soldiers. Get in a cab and start talking to the cab driver or start talking to random people, and you will see that unfortunately this feeling of resentment towards Kurds does exist. It does signal to something, a deep current underneath that we need to really focus on.
But other Turks have reached out to those affected by the earthquake. On Wednesday, TV stations ran a nationwide appeal raising millions of euros, and a call for people to donate warm clothing received a strong response. But even here, organizers are reporting that they are finding obscene notes condemning Kurds in the pockets of donated clothes. It's such a problem that all items are now being searched. Concern over such ethnic hatred prompted the Turkish Prime Minister Recep Tayyip Erdogan to angrily condemn it.
Ayrımcılığa ilişkin her ifade, her tavır, her ima insanlık dışıdır.
Each word, each phrase, each impression of discrimination is inhumane and unconscionable. It's sickening and it's enough.
The Prime Minister should be concerned, according to retired Brigadier Haldan Solmazturk. He spent much of his career fighting the Kurdish rebel group, the PKK. He says the upsurge in fighting over the past few months, which has claimed the lives of more than 50 Turkish soldiers, is fueling a deepening and worrying ethnic polarization.
There has been a rapidly growing reaction to the events in southeastern Turkey, especially these ambushes. And people are looking for an answer. People are looking for an explanation, which are not answered by neither politicians nor bureaucrats. So the tension is just building up. And this reaction is directed to the Kurdish people. At some stage, a small spark could ignite an action, an actual attack. I am afraid that there is a potentiality such a conflict, once sparked, could spread throughout Turkey.
The Van earthquake is now taking increasingly symbolic importance. Will such a tragedy unite Turkey or further polarize it? Whatever the outcome, it will probably have far-reaching consequences for the country. Dorian Jones, Deutsche Welle Radio, Istanbul.
For radio on the road, download the latest in news and current affairs from Deutsche Welle's European Weekly, Inside Europe. Go to dwworld.de/inside-europe and click on download. Or subscribe the show. Click on the podcast button on DW World's front page. That's dwworld.de for the latest podcasts. Don't leave home without one.
I'm Chuck Penfold in Bonn. You're listening to Inside Europe. In these uncertain times, those who are lucky enough to actually have money to spend are wondering just where to invest their hard-earned cash. Chinese investors seem to think they've found the answer. They're currently snapping up London real estate. According to a recent report, one in three buyers of newly built London homes comes from China. Property developers say London offers a safe haven in the current global economic downturn. But they also hope major Chinese investment will help them finish building developments plagued by cash flow problems ever since the financial crisis first hit. Nina Maria Potts reports from London.
London's Docklands was once the city's industrial heart and the world's largest port. Now property developers are looking to China to lift the area out of recession. They insist London is a safe bet in tough economic times, especially for Chinese investing for the long term. Sherry Madeira is Managing Director International for the Chinese property website LuckyWoo.com.
Chinese investors are following the likes of the Russian investors and perhaps the Arabic investors who came previously to bolster the London market. It's seen as a safe haven. It's seen as a property market that is going to continue to rise. And with a little bit of patience, I think that property investors will still do very well.
Sherry Madeira is so confident about the strength of the Chinese property market, she's launched the world's first Mandarin web portal to attract Chinese investors, many of whom never even visit London before putting down a deposit.
5,000 miles away is a long way to come. but the investor, and often you can't really see stocks or bonds. So in the same way that you're looking at property as being an asset class, a lot of Chinese investors never come and walk around their property. They do it on the basis of yield, they do it on the basis of potential upside for the property itself, and they do it on the basis of recommendations and trust through the agencies and through the people that they're buying the properties from.
Despite the optimism, it's hard to overlook the impact of the economic downturn on London's new building projects. Property developers say ever since the financial crisis of 2008, it's been very hard to get development funding, and it's still a struggle today, which is why they're looking to China, where evidence of pre-sales can make it somewhat easier to persuade the banks to lend them the money to build. But some concede Chinese investors are still cautious. Ian Cohen of City and Docklands has been in the business for years.
Beijing and Shanghai is opening up, but it's a slow process because education, they need to understand exactly what it is, and they need to, you know, have a little bit more time to feel into the market. I think it's still in an early stage of buying from mainland China, but Hong Kong, the Hong Kong buyers are very shrewd and they understand the market implicitly in London. They really do understand it really, really well. They do their research.
Because London is seen as an economical place to buy, developers say Chinese investors sometimes buy up whole floors, especially in apartment blocks like this one, with urban cityscape views. Though yields are important, it is not always about the money. Again, Ian Cohen.
You get parents obviously want to put their kids into apartments here who are studying in London. But mostly it's people who have a varied investment history and they want to put an asset class as property in London. What we've seen, we've got a lot of mainland Chinese, obviously students, workers now coming into Canary Wharf, so being brought over by their companies over here on contracts of a year, 2 year contracts, etc. So we're seeing a lot of Chinese, and in fact if you take a walk around the streets here, you'll see a lot of Chinese people here.
Other attractions include a floating Chinese restaurant. There are even courtyards in new developments named after places in Beijing and Shanghai. China is still an untapped market, but there are hopes recent changes to property legislation will make it easier for Chinese to buy property overseas. Property developers like Ian Cohen say they are still banking on China.
You know, it's only a few years ago that mainland China was quite closed off to the rest of the world. And when you were looking at whether people over there would be investing in their own properties, no one was really sure because no one really understood what was going on. Now you can see it's becoming such a powerhouse and such a, you know, capitalist society when you look at it. And you look at what they're buying their own properties and they're buying off plan. And you know, they understand that side of it very, very well. So we would, as a company, we're definitely looking to mainland China, 100%.
Walking through London's Docklands, it's hard to get a real sense of whether the market is as buoyant as it seems. But property developers insist Chinese investors are often discreet and the apartments don't lend themselves to an extravagant show of money. But judging by the figures, Chinese investors do seem to be on the rise in London, and there's no apparent sign that tough economic times are driving them away. Nina Mrepots, Deutsche Welle Radio, London.
Well, foreign investment is also set to make a difference to the tiny Swiss village of Andermatt. It's undergoing a controversial makeover in a bid to revive its flagging rural economy. If successful, the project will turn the village into one of the most exclusive and expensive resorts in the world. Imogen Folks has the details.
Andermatt in the Swiss Alps. Spectacular scenery and a tiny village, population just 1,300 people. But the traditional tranquility of this little corner of Switzerland has been disrupted. Someone has very big plans for Andermatt.
I'm just a developer that happens to have been lucky to find this opportunity and is now working together with the local population to grow the village.
Egyptian billionaire developer Sami Sawiris cultivates a modest approach, but his plans for Andermatt are anything but. 5 upmarket hotels, 30 villas, 500 apartments, designer boutiques, not to mention a golf course and a massively expanded ski area. As his sales manager Sarah Collins explains, such a huge project has caused a certain amount of upheaval.
This chalet belongs to us. And we actually moved it. We actually moved it up. Moved it how many inches? I think it was just, it was just like maybe 2 meters, if at all. We moved it across the entire building.
In fact, Andermatt is now the site of the biggest resort building project ever undertaken in the Alps. But Sarah Collins promises, when it's finished, it will offer the last word in luxury.
We're going to be having an après-ski lounge and an après-ski bar where a ski butler is going to bring your warm ski boots, take your skis to the lift, you know, those kind of things that we'd always love. And actually physically take you to the ski lift if you do not want to walk.
Well, he will carry you.
You know, he has little, it will be a cute little golf cart.
Of course. Yeah.
But walking through the original village of Andermatt, with its cobbled streets and traditional houses which have scarcely changed for hundreds of years, it is a bit hard to see how this new project will fit with the old. I'm on my way to see local doctor Andreas von Schultes. He, from on, isn't convinced.
It's just huge and nothing else. I mean, it doesn't fit in the Andermatt as it was before. So it's really a forcible development of this originally small and place with a certain charm. It has a certain charm, this village. For me, it's a brutal change of Andermatt.
But Andermatt was stagnating. The biggest contributor to the local economy was once the Swiss Army. Its mountain regiments trained here. When the army pulled out, shops and restaurants closed, young people left. That's why so many locals back the project. Farmer Maya Regley is happy to accept the upheaval if it keeps Andermatt alive. She thought she'd have to abandon her farm to make way for the bulldozers. Now she's happy she can keep it, although it will be surrounded by the new 18-hole golf course.
There had to be something else. There had to be an investor, but yes, now Swiss came and the problems were solved, probably, I don't know. We don't know now what it will be in about 2 or 3 years when they will be playing golf. And yeah, we are wondering what will be then.
And many questions do remain. So far, not many of the luxury apartments have been sold. Perhaps not surprising, since the smallest one-bedroom version costs around $500,000. What's more, environmental groups are likely to fight planning permission for the new ski lifts. But Sami Siwiris insists Andermatt will benefit.
From every project I do, I make sure that everybody around it is a winner. We are not talking about a project that is separate from the village. We are finally talking about Andermatt. And I did not want to come here and compete with the locals. That would have been a very silly proposition from my part to the village. And why not make everybody a winner?
And so the bulldozers grind on, creating a new luxury village side by side with the old one. Radical measures for uncertain economic times. It won't be finished until 2013. But one thing is certain, this little corner of the Alps will never be the same again. Imogen Folks, Deutsche Welle Radio, Andermatt in the Swiss Alps.
If you haven't already entered our October quiz, here's another chance to do so. This month, Germans celebrated the 21st anniversary of reunification. But Unity Day was celebrated before that. From 1954 until 1990, it was held on a different date, marking a famous uprising in the former East Germany back in 1953. We want you to tell us on which date it was held. Our address is europe@dw-world.de. Or write to us the old-fashioned way at Inside Europe, the European Desk, Deutsche Welle Radio, Bonn, Germany. We'll announce our 5 winners next month. This is Inside Europe, and I'm Chuck Penfold in Bonn. Thank you. This is Inside Europe, and I'm Chuck Penfold in Bonn. Over the next half hour, Scotland's ruling party unveils its bid for independence. But can they afford to go it alone?
The problem's going to happen if Scotland left the Union, North Sea oil is due to dry up, and therefore you'd have a big deficit where Scotland would have enormous problems trying to maintain these very, very high levels of public spending.
Also on the programme, did Adolf Hitler live out his last days in Argentina? And has a Roman villa fallen victim to bureaucratic bungling? And the regional German beer that's been making a big splash on the export market. Those stories and more coming up. Scotland's ruling party, the Scottish National Party, or SNP, has just ended its annual conference in a buoyant mood, optimistic and riding high in the opinion polls. The SNP runs what is called a devolved government within the UK. But the SNP is a separatist party. It wants Scotland to break away from Britain. And its leader, Scotland's First Minister Alex Salmond, says a breakup of the Union is now as near inevitable as anything can be. That's bad news for the United Kingdom. But as Stephen Beard reports from Edinburgh, it may not be good for Scotland either.
Alex Salmond has always seemed immensely pleased with himself, but now he has good reason. This summer, his Scottish National Party won full control of the government of Scotland.
The Scottish Party carries your hope, and we shall carry it carefully and make the nation proud.
And he might have added, independent. Salmond's dream of a separate state is edging towards reality. Some financial independence is already on the way. The Scots will soon be able to issue their own government bonds, dubbed Braveheart bonds, after the movie about Scotland's historic struggle to free itself from the English.
That they may take our lives, but they'll never take our freedom!
Red-blooded Scots may be thrilled by the talk of freedom and independence, but opinion polls still show a majority against it. Out on the streets of Glasgow, many people fret about whether Scotland could afford to go it alone.
No, I don't think Scotland could cope with that.
You need England.
Yeah, I'm afraid so.
Do you think Scotland could survive economically on its own?
Probably not. Probably not.
Many Scots feel more economically secure within the United Kingdom. Magnus Linklater is Scotland editor of the Times newspaper.
I think the experience of our two main banks has really brought that home to people.
He says the Scots only have to think back to 2008 and the rescue of two enormous banks by the UK taxpayers, the Bank of Scotland and the Royal Bank of Scotland.
If Scotland had been independent around that time, who would have bailed out our banks?
The 1 o'clock gun fires out from Edinburgh Castle. Rich in cultural history, this ancient city was nicknamed the Athens of the North. That link with Greece would have had a horrible resonance if an independent Scotland had had to bail out its own banks. Economist Brian Ashcroft says Scotland would have suffered a worse fate than other heavily indebted European countries.
Scotland would have been in a worse than Iceland situation when within the United Kingdom we're actually doing relatively okay.
In fact, he says Scotland is doing better than the UK as a whole in terms of public spending. It's much more lavish than in England. Free university tuition, free social care for the elderly, all subsidised by English taxpayers to keep the kingdom united.
Those who wish to keep the Union together wanted to keep the Scots comparatively happy.
It's the squeaky wheel getting the grease.
Absolutely, and I think that's right. And no UK Prime Minister wants to be seen to preside over a breakup of the Union.
The Scottish National Party claims that an independent Scotland could still afford its extra public spending. The country pumps 1 million barrels of oil a day from the North Sea. With independence, most of that revenue would pour into Scottish coffers and not into the British Treasury. Alex Salmond says Scotland is ready to go it alone. It's an insult to suggest anything else.
It is a ridiculous argument to argue that Scotland's not big enough, good enough, bright enough to run a very successful country. Of course we are, and I hope that very soon the people of Scotland will have the opportunity to say yes to that proposition.
But the sceptics say the campaign for Scottish independence is the high road to ruin. North Sea oil is an uncertain resource. Production has peaked and is declining. Tom Myers, a public policy consultant.
The problem's going to happen if Scotland left the Union, North Sea oil is due to dry up, and therefore you'd have a big deficit where Scotland would have enormous problems trying to maintain these very, very high levels of public spending.
Though hundreds worship at his word, he's but a coup for all.
When the Scottish Parliament opened 12 years ago, a folk singer sang A Man's a Man for All That, the national hymn to equality. But critics of the campaign for independence say if the Scots really want equality with the English, they're much more likely to get it within the United Kingdom. Stephen Beard, Deutsche Welle Radio, Edinburgh.
A prince can mark a belted knight, a marquis duke and all that. But an honest man's up in his might, get faith he manna for that.
On February 13, 1962, an old man died peacefully in his bed in a small remote village in Argentina. But not just any old man. According to a new book, it was Adolf Hitler. The book, called Grey Wolf, claims that Hitler escaped Berlin in the final days of World War II and, together with his wife Eva Braun, fled to Argentina, where they had two daughters and lived peacefully until their deaths. Journalist Gerard Williams co-authored the book, and I asked him how, according to his research, Adolf Hitler and Eva Braun escaped from Berlin unnoticed in 1945.
Well, it doesn't seem to be unnoticed. We have the testimony of Captain Peter Baumgart, who flew them out from the Hohenzollern-Damm in Berlin to an airfield in Denmark, Tonda, the former Imperial Zeppelin base. It also doesn't seem to have gone unnoticed by Zhukov, who was in charge of the Soviet forces at the time, who said that they had escaped and that they had an airfield at their disposal. And it definitely didn't go unnoticed by Stalin, who said for a long time after the war they had escaped to either Spain or Argentina. So what has always amazed me is that there is no actual factual information, there are no forensics or anything else to prove that they died in the bunker. And yet post-war, there are numerous eyewitnesses, both German officers who were serving at the time, and later in Argentina, many, many people who actually saw the Hitlers together after the war.
How did they spend the rest of their lives in Argentina?
It sounds pretty boring and quite bourgeois. I think for the early part, there was some hope that Hitler could lead a resurgence of that awful thing, Nazism. But I think that as soon as the world realized how terrible the regime had been, what had happened in the Holocaust and anything else, that the American intelligence officers and the American financiers who had colluded in this escape realized that there was no way that anybody could ever march behind the swastika again. And as such, he was just thrown away to history. He ended up as a sad, demented, tormented and betrayed man in the foothills of the Andes.
Now, obviously, your account flies in the face of the almost universally accepted account of history. You mentioned a bit of the evidence you had have at the top of this interview. But what is the most compelling evidence you have that would convince somebody who's grown up with the knowledge, basically, that he committed suicide?
I think it's very difficult to pricey 384 pages of a book here. The evidence is compelling. I think the one thing that made me take it incredibly seriously was when two of our witnesses, two of our sources in Argentina, both received death threats. And I couldn't understand why anybody would want to suggest that they would be putting their lives at risk for talking to us and telling us about Hitler's life in Argentina post-war. I also can't understand how the evidence was ignored, that the evidence of the pilot who gave it to a Warsaw court in 1947 was completely ignored and not followed up. And the SS officer on the ground in Denmark, his interrogation details Hitler and Eva, and Eva's sister, Ilse, getting off the plane in Tonda. Why did the British put Hugh Trevor Roper, who was nothing more than an Oxford academic who had spent the whole war listening to radio intercepts, why did they put him in charge of the investigation into Adolf Hitler's death? And why did a BBC reporter who arrived on the scene with the Soviet forces have this to say?
Outside the front door of the shelter are the five perforated petrol tins that were believed to have been used for scattering petrol on the body of Hitler and of burning it. But there, at any rate, my Soviet friends found no trace of Hitler himself.
Well, of course, saying that he hasn't found any trace of Hitler doesn't mean that he didn't exist or that the body wasn't present somewhere.
Well, he not only says he didn't find any trace of Hitler, but the Soviets didn't find any trace of Hitler. And this is something that in the early days of May 1945, after the Soviets took the bunker area, that they repeat consistently, that they were handed doubles of Hitler, but dead bodies who were meant to be doubles of Hitler, but they were not handed any remains that could have been Adolf Hitler. In the book, we prove for the first time scientifically, one of the top facial recognition experts working with the Metropolitan Police in London, Sir Alf Linney, has proved that the final pictures of Hitler taken on March the 20th, 1945, with the Hitler Youth in Berlin are not those of Adolf Hitler. It is a double. This is the first time that anybody's proved that Hitler was using a double on a regular basis, although it has been theorised about for many years. We believe it's that double who was executed in the bunker, his body taken upstairs along with that of a double for Eva Braun, and possibly burnt in the garden. There are witnesses to those bodies being taken up out of the bunker into the garden area, but nobody ever saw their faces.
Now, I read that the Russian intelligence service, the FSB, I guess used to be known as the KGB, has said that it plans to publish its files on Hitler's death in an effort to disprove your story. So what do you make of this?
I welcome that completely. I mean, if the SFB are taking us as seriously as they appear to be, and they're finally going to open up the files, which will prove that Adolf Hitler died in the bunker, then my co-author and I have got this very, very seriously wrong. However, most of those files have been exposed before by Lev Brzezinski, and they didn't go any way to explaining why the skull fragment, which for 60-something years has been said by the Russians to be that of Adolf Hitler, held by the FSB in Moscow, has turned out through testing by American DNA experts to be that of a woman over 40. It simply cannot be Adolf Hitler's skull.
You mentioned that a couple of your sources, I believe it was, have had death threats over the book. Where did these death threats come from? I mean, what are these people afraid of who may be making these death threats?
I think a great deal of money in many different forms, from bearer bonds to treasure to shares in companies that still exist today, went with the Nazis who escaped to South America. And that money still exists today. We've spent quite a lot of our time and quite a lot of the research in following the money, which is always a good way to start in any sort of any detective case. I think that there are interests within Latin America and interests within the corporate world in the United States who simply do not want this story to come out. And they have people in Argentina who monitor various people who have been involved within that German community there. And it was from them, I believe, that the death threats came out to Captain Monasterio, who was 83, and to Mrs. Olga Muller in Cordoba, who said that she would look for pictures of Adolf Hitler that she knew existed from his time in Argentina after the war, and for signed copies of various books that he'd given to Nazis in Cordoba province in the late 40s, early 50s.
Still, you know, Hitler died, in, well, according to your version of events, in Argentina in 1962. I understand that the money then may be involved, according to your story, but the Nazi regime is ancient history. So would it really have any impact if your version of events were to become the accepted wisdom?
I quite agree. The Nazi regime is ancient history, and thank goodness for it. What I think we are trying to find out is the truth of what happened. Sadly, governments lie all the time. We've seen that in the United Kingdom with the Bloody Sunday inquiry, which took 42 years to come to any sort of fruition. We know that the BND, the German Secret Service, knew where Adolf Eichmann was, knew his name and his address in Argentina from 1952, but they never shared that information with anybody. That has only recently come out through the activities of a very courageous journalist in Germany to push for those BND files to be opened. We would like those files to be opened concerning Adolf Hitler and his existence post-war. We believe that there are FBI files, British Security Service files, and almost definitely BND files, which will prove this. If we've got this wrong, well, the amount of information that we've found, the amount of information that's available there to any researcher, will enable people to make up their own mind. What we're looking for is the truth about this story.
Okay, now this is certainly a great yarn, and you have to sell books, I get that. But do you, deep down, just between you and me, really believe this is the truth?
Chuck, I've been a journalist since I was 18, which is almost 34 years. I've held senior positions at Reuters Television, the BBC, Sky News, Associated Press. When I first came across this story, I thought I was just going to do a very silly conspiracy theory film. And that's how it started off. as we started to look at the information available to us, as we looked at the accepted history, we realised that there was a lot more to this. You're right, we want to sell books, but we also want to get the truth out. I've never done a conspiracy theory story in my life as a journalist, and I don't intend to start now. This is something where we have sourced all our information. There are over 500 footnotes in the book, over 50-odd pages, and it's up to other people if they want to come and tell us what we have wrong. I've tried to be a good journalist on this one and just report what we have found out.
I was speaking with Jared Williams, who, together with Simon Dunstan, has written Grey Wolf, The Escape of Adolf Hitler. It's published by Sterling. I'm Chuck Penfold in Bonn. You're listening to Inside Europe. Back in 1997, a Roman villa in Sicily was designated a UNESCO heritage site. The Villa Romana del Casale dates back to the 4th century and contains the richest and largest collection of Roman mosaics in the world. The site received a 30 million euro grant from the EU for much-needed restoration work. But 3 years after the deadline for completion, that work has not been finished and the locals are in despair. Naomi Fowler has been finding out more.
I'm standing outside what should be Sicily's crowning pride and joy. The Villa Romana del Casale in Piazza Armerina has got 46 rooms of beautiful mosaics, 11,000 square feet of them.
My name is Giuseppina Belfiore. I'm a tour guide and I work on the Roman villa and in other sites in Sicily, though this is my favourite one because it's one of the most unexpected experiences you can make in Sicily. It's beautiful.
I first came to Piazza Armerina to see the Roman villa about 15 years ago. I'd never seen such beautiful and extensive mosaics, but I was shocked by the poor site management and the ugly plastic roofing exposing the mosaics to harsh sunlight. And I couldn't believe that tourists could walk freely on top of some of them. I had hoped the UNESCO heritage inscription and the 30 million euro European Union grant was good news for one of Sicily's most beautiful ancient sites. But from what I've seen here, not much has changed.
We got great expectations. Many of them had been disappointed. Delay after delay after delay. We lost a lot of tourists. For the next year, if we won't be ready, they won't come anymore.
Rumours are flying in the local town about why this restoration project is 3 years behind schedule. Local people here told me about intimidation and threats towards them when they tried to raise objections about the works and the site management. Many of them are angry about this man, responsible for overseeing the restoration.
Rispettala, non delle cretinate, sono stati vittime dei comunisti,
ispirato dai santi.
Uccisi e martiri, ignorante, capra.
This is Vittorio Scarpi. He's a politician and friend of Berlusconi, and he's famous for insulting people on live television. He's been fined thousands of euros for defamation on various occasions, absenteeism as a parliamentarian, and fraud against the state. Local councillor Riccardo Calamaio proposed a motion in the local council to remove him from his post as high commissioner overseeing the restoration works. The motion wasn't carried.
In questa occasione, l'unico che non perde è Sgarbi.
The only one who can't lose is Sgarbi. He gains 15% of the ticket price. Of course, if the villa sells more tickets, he'll also make more.
Sei, voglio essere anche un po' cattivello.
But if I were to be a little mischievous, if the works last a long time, he has the right to remain High Commissioner for a long time.
Per tanto tempo.
The start but they never finish. Because it's normal Sicilian way of doing, that it have to go slowly, very slowly, no? So it will cost more money.
Ulla Mortensen lives close to the mosaics. There's nobody working there.
No. It's the way that have always been here, no? If you make a road and you don't finish the road, and then there will be an excuse that it's much more expensive than they expect, so they will get more money. Because they are used that every work they get, a percent will go to some other people who get the job, have to give some money to the people who have given them the job. And it's a mafia.
Some local people told me they tried to alert UNESCO to the problems with the Villa Romana site. Susan Denyer's a World Heritage Advisor. I asked her to explain how UNESCO works in partnership with local authorities once the site's been inscribed.
Well, the simple answer is UNESCO isn't there, doesn't do anything. Once the site is inscribed, it is the responsibility of what's called the state party, or that means the government, to take responsibility for that site. Because it's the governments that ratify the World Heritage Convention.
What happens with a body like UNESCO when the government may appear to be part of the problem?
The convention has to work on the basis of dialogue, goodwill, understanding. It's the local people, local communities, local stakeholders that ultimately should be the custodians of these sites. Then it's they who should be, you know, motivated to look after it, which can happen because we can see really good examples around the world. And we want more of that. We want more of this engagement process.
And so it seems it's down to pressure from people like Councillor Ricardo Calamayo, who's helped fight and win victories in the past with other renovation projects that weren't delivering.
We knew we'd have to be a thorn in the side of the regional and local administrations for many years. But after 12 years of fighting over it, we are beginning to see some results. That's only thanks to the activities of free citizens standing up together, for which I'm grateful.
So one day, local people here hope these incredible mosaics are no longer exposed to the sun and they'll be in a museum-standard, air-conditioned environment. One day, they hope tourists won't be able to walk on them. One day, they hope the Villa Romana del Casale is where it should be, at the heart of the community here, central to Sicilian pride of their incredibly rich heritage, bringing in revenue that benefits everyone. Naomi Fowler, Deutsche Welle Radio, Piazza Armerina, Sicily.
dwworld.de, Deutsche Welle's internet website. We bring you news and views from a European perspective. You'll find information about current affairs, business and economics, culture and lifestyle. You can even learn German with our online German courses. And, of course, we bring you the latest program details for DWTV and DW Radio. Deutsche Welle on the internet at dwworld.de.
German beer is known all over the world for its high quality. As a result, it's possible to order one in New York, Sydney, or Paris, pretty much anywhere. More often than not, the German beers sold in other countries are licensed from major brands like Beck's. But in recent years, a lesser-known beer from the city of Cologne has been making a splash in the export market. Experienced beer drinker and dedicated reporter Catherine Bolzover went to find out just what's behind this little beer's sudden rise in popularity.
In the beer halls of Cologne, there's only one type of beer being served. It's not some frothy wheat beer being served in gigantic steins, but a clear, straw-coloured beer in small, thin glasses. Heinrich Philipp Becker is CEO of one of Cologne's many Kölsch breweries, Gaffelkölsch.
Well, Kölsch is a very light type of top-fermented ale. It's only being produced in Cologne, officially. You can pretty much compare it to Champagne, which can only be produced in the area of Champagne in France. And it's the same with Kölsch, actually, which has an official European protection that it can only be produced in Köln.
Visitors to the city cannot miss the beer. It's served in every pub and restaurant, and to order any other kind of beer is seriously frowned upon by the locals. Outside of Cologne and the Rhineland, Kölsch is less easy to come by. It's more common to find a pilsner like Beck's or Bitburger, or a wheat beer made by Erdinger or Paulaner. However, although 90% of their Kölsch stays in the country, Becker says there's a growing international interest in Cologne's local brew.
We can see that there's an increasing demand from all over the world, actually. The United States have been a very strong market for us. We actually had a 200% sales increase in the last 2 years in the United States. But there are also countries like Russia, which is very prominent, China, Brazil also, that are actually picking up the Kölsch culture.
Gaffel is one of the big three Kölsch brands, alongside Fru and Reisdorf. It's these three who have been the most popular exports. In the UK, one importer tells me that their imports of Fru Kölsch have doubled in the past 12 months.
Yeah, it's a great beer.
In the Drafthouse pub in London, near the landmark Tower Bridge, Fru Kölsch has been served on tap for the past month. Beverage manager Sean Voss buys in the beers for the pub and says German beers have a reputation for quality.
Kölsch is a fantastic beer, really light, really easy to drink. We found that it really does suit the English style of drinking because it's really easy drinking and not overly powerful in flavour. And that means that you can drink a fair amount of it without going to the head really, really quickly.
In Cologne, the beer is served in a tiny glass called a Stanger. That's German for rod, and it's only 200 millilitres in volume. It's a totally different style of drinking for the British palate, where the beers are normally served by the pint, almost three times the size.
Cheers.
Cheers.
Cheers. Obviously, we try and serve it in a Kölsch Stange if we can, but the English style of drinking differs from the German style of drinking, whereby a lot of people tend to drink pints of it rather than halves or even third. So, yeah, we sell quite a lot of pints of it.
This would be seen as sacrilege to the traditional Kölsch drinker. However, Cologne residents couldn't help but be proud at how well the beer is being received abroad.
Yeah, it's really good, really good. It's a lot better than the tripe we get over here. There's only a select few pubs over here that sell it, but more and more are starting to get in now.
And how do you feel about having such a small dose of the beer?
Well, I understand the logic behind it to keep it cold, but it is ingrained in my DNA to drink it out of a pint, so I do feel a little bit cheated.
To be honest, I usually stick with wine, but this is really good. It's not as heavy as the other lagers, and I'd never drink ale, but this is great. I think I'm a German beer virgin.
I'm normally an ale man, and I was interested to discover tonight that this is actually an ale, so it's right up my alley. I'd definitely order it again, in fact I just have, and yeah, it's very nice, it's very fresh, perfect for the summer.
In addition to a growth in exports, the Kölsch style of beer has also picked up admirers and imitators who are brewing their own version of the ale. In theory, they cannot actually call it Kölsch unless it's brewed within the city of Cologne. Heinrich Philipp Becker from Gaffel Kölsch again.
In Europe, if some other brewery outside of Cologne would produce Kölsch beer, we would actually be not amused, let's say, and probably do something against it. However, there's many microbreweries, especially in the United States, and we also see this in Latin America, who produce Kölsch-style beer in small, small quantities. So it's not really a danger for us or for our market. And we see them a little more as, let's say, ambassadors of the category Kölsch.
So, do the people at Gaffel actually sample these different types of beer?
We try all of them. We are specialists at beer, and beer is what we do best. Okay, so we try pretty much every beer that we get. But we have many fans and followers of the brand, so whenever they go all over the world and they discover a Kölsch from Brazil or a Kölsch from Boston or something, they bring it to us and then we try a bottle or something. It's always fun.
Growing beer markets in China, Russia and Kenya are where Gaffel hopes to develop next. They and other Kölsch brewers will be hoping the sudden thirst for their beer is more than just a summer fad. Catherine Bolsova, Deutsche Welle Radio.
That's all for this week's edition of Inside Europe. I hope you enjoyed the program. For producer Helen Cini and sound engineer Mark Reuling, I'm Chuck Penfold. Inside Europe comes to you from Deutsche Welle Radio in Bonn.
You've been listening to a podcast from Deutsche Welle. We hope you enjoyed the programme. You'll find more information and podcasts at dwworld.de.